today, Monday, March 2nd, 2009, and we will open up
a work session
on what?
To introduce committee bills.
Introduce committee bills.
Katie wants to do this since Representative Bailey's office.
So, colleagues, we're going to be... We're going to be introducing these committee bills, and there's no obligation to ever support them or vote for them or even vote on them. If they come to committee, you'll have to vote on them.
Do you mind if I move these in as I'm walking?
Yes.
Okay.
That's fine. Okay.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move that the following LCs in block would be moved forward then and be introduced as committee bills. They would be LC 653, dated January 22nd, 09. LC 2344, February 18th, 09. LC 2349, February 16th. LC 2698, February 23rd. LC 2699, January 27th. LC 2700, dated January 27th. LC 2701, also January 27th, 09. LC 2702, dated February 23rd, 09, and LC 3077, dated February 19th, 2009.
Representative Olson moves that the so-named bills be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. What is so funny?
It's hard to say if I object or not after that. sorry, Representative Olson.
We just want compliance. That's all.
That's right. The measures are introduced as committee bills. Thank you, committee. And we'll move on to public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 164. Healy.
Senate Bill 164 aligns state statute with federal law regarding the look-back period that Department of Human Services uses to determine whether an individual has made disqualifying transfer of assets during the period that Medicaid eligibility is being determined. And this measure passed the Senate with 28 ayes and 2 excused voters.
Okay. Do we have anyone here who is wishing to speak on this bill? Seeing none. Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, actually, yeah. I do have some questions about it. I mean, we're aligning with federal law. I get that. It is the look back period means that if you had qualifying assets in the last 5 years, then you would not be eligible for Medicaid. There's a wait period.
Correct.
And so try to get around the gaming of the system.
Right.
And the one question I have. Of course, the department isn't here, maybe.
Is the department here? If you want to come talk with us about this, thank you. Thank you for your question, Representative Maher. Oh, she does have something. Good.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Deanna Hartwig, Administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, Department of Human Services.
You want to give us your take on this bill?
Sure. The Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 changed the federal law regarding the asset look-behind period for certain individuals applying for Medicaid. Those individuals are aged, physically disabled, and developmentally disabled individuals. It changed the look-back period for those individuals from 3 years to 5 years. It did not, however, change the look-back time period for any other client group. So the department now has differing look-back periods, only one of which is 5 years. So we're asking that you remove Section 1BC relating to asset transfers, as there are existing federal and state regulations to guide the department when making these evaluations.
Thank you. Does that answer your question, Representative Maher?
Madam Chair, it doesn't, but, I mean, I'm supportive of the bill. I mean, that's not the issue. The issue is... and this has been in casual conversations with my wife, because we have because in what used to be our clinic, we have this issue comes up a lot with Oregon Health Plan, is that what we, I mean, people admit, and I can't give you names because I actually don't know them, but that people are gaming the system. They move grandma or mom usually from out of state, usually East Coast, out to the West Coast, and they say, they sign an affidavit said, yeah, we've disposed of all the assets. But in fact, they haven't disposed of the assets, and the assets still remain. They may have changed names. But how do we follow that up? I mean, is there, it just seems, you know, I really don't like to see is people intentionally gaming the system, knowing it, and you know, essentially for the profit of the son or the daughter.
Right. Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, you are correct. We do ask when people apply for Medicaid to indicate if they've transferred any assets and if they've transferred them in now what will be a five-year period. Because the intent of the state and federal regulation is to prohibit the inappropriate transfer. One thing that the federal government has recently instituted is an asset verification system. Oregon is one of the next group of states that will be involved in what was a pilot, where there will be an opportunity to check at least bank accounts in surrounding areas where an individual has indicated they have an account. So we will check branch offices in a certain federally defined radius. I don't know if it's 50 miles or 100 miles. So there is one other endeavor that we will be implementing over the next 18 to 24 months that will help verify that people have not transferred their assets inappropriately, solely for the purpose of becoming eligible for Medicaid.
Those are bank accounts, not real.
Correct. It is one thing. You know, we will ask, what did you do with your house? And if they say they don't own a house, we'll ask, did you own one? Did you sell it? When did you sell it? How much did you sell it for? Did you give it away? What? And if they did that within the past 5 years, we will calculate a period of time that they are ineligible to apply for Medicaid. So if you have a five-year look back and they transferred their house 3 years back, you'll calculate a three-year waiting period.
If they had, ma'am,
follow up.
If they admit that they've had a house and that they transferred it, the state says, they acknowledge it and say, please let us know when you sell it so that we can, and
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, it may be that they sold the house. It may be that they put the house in their child's name. It could be they did a number of things with it. So if they have indeed done that within the five-year look-back period, we will calculate the value of that house as an asset. And depending upon all the calculations, if it puts them over the income eligibility, they have to wait out a period of time. The only difference is today it's a three-year, now it will be a five-year.
Okay, Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dana, so what would be examples of groups that will now come under this five-year rule that otherwise wouldn't have?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembrow, it is any aged, physically disabled, developmentally disabled, or person with mental health issues who applies for long-term care Medicaid services. So if you want any of our home and community-based services or nursing facility services, and you have transferred your assets within that five-year period in an inappropriate fashion, you will have to wait out a period before reapplying. Just to point out, other parts of the department do not have the five-year look back. For example, Children, Adults, and Families does not have a five-year look back because they were not part of the federal regulation, and people applying for the Oregon Health Plan don't have a five-year look back. So this was just specific for individuals applying for long-term care, nursing facility, in-home care, and community-based care in these population groups.
And this does bring us in line with federal law, correct?
Representative Tomei, that is correct. We, our statute is not in compliance with the federal regulations
as
at this point
now.
In time.
Great, thank you.
That'll probably cover mine because I was just going to ask what happens if a person has an accident, a debilitating accident, and needs to be in long-term care.
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, there are some hardship criteria that we are able to use in extreme situations.
Okay. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I understand what the bill says, we're removing Section 1C, the paragraph in italics, and then relying on the statement that other information may be, as may be required pursuant to state or federal laws applicable. Is that where it says we go back, we go to the five-year federal applicable law?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, we have administrative rules that are senior and people with disabilities, eligibility workers utilize to determine eligibility. The rule that they follow has a five-year time period in it for the look back. So our administrative rules are in alignment with the federal statute. It's somewhat unusual for an Oregon statute to have this specific federal requirement in it, which is the reason we're asking to remove a time period, because otherwise we'd be back here every time the federal government changes their look-back time period.
All right. Thank you. That helps. It's all right. We all call them.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 164 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 164 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any questions? Any objections? Can we just do this by
proclamation?
Yes, having received the required majority, this motion passes. I think we should put this on the consent calendar, or does somebody want to carry this?
Consent.
Okay. This goes on the consent calendar, 164. All right. I close the work session on Senate Bill 164 and open up a work session on 2052. Representative Olson, well, Keith, why don't you read this first?
Okay. This amends the Oregon statutes on halfway houses to include requiring public agencies to inform the local public safety coordinating council of the agency's intent to cite a resident for individuals under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board in that council's locality. It amends the duties of the public safety coordinating council to include appointment of a subcommittee for reviewing agency proposals.
Thank you. Representative Olson. Do you have anything to say about this?
Yeah, Madam Chair and committee members, you've heard the testimony regarding this about a week and a half ago, and at that time we were considering doing some Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments that you have in front of you right now actually are reflected in, you should have a copy of a Hand and Gross bill that Keeley did, and we've gone through all the different pieces that we were wanting to do for what the Dash 1s did. So the Hand and Gross encompasses and involves all of those from the Dash 1s, and then it also includes a small little portion of what the Dash 2s indicates, which is at the very bottom of the page, the third page of the Hand and Gross. And it talks about subsection F, which would be a consumer as defined in ORS 4300721. And that's reflected, too, in the Dash 1s, or Dash 2s, excuse me. So, I mean, with that, everybody, I mean, done a lot of work with this, and I think we're able to move forward with this at this time.
Okay. Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just want to thank Richard and his staff and others for coming and having lengthy conversations with me and working out some of the details on this. I truly appreciated that. So
good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions or discussion? I want to thank Representative Olson, who I know has put in many, many hours and days on this issue, and I really appreciate all the work you've done, including all the stakeholders, too. So.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated February 23rd, 2009.
Representative Olson moves the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you. Where are we? Oh, dated February 23rd, 2009. Any questions or discussion? All right. Any objection? Dash two amendments adopted. Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, I would move that House Bill 2052 with the dash two amendments be moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2052 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. You can start from the top this time, Zach.
Representative Cowan?
Yes.
Representative Dimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
You bet.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Olson?
Yes.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. House Bill 2052 has amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Olson, would you like to?
Absolutely
carry this bill?
Would. And one final note, Madam Chair. There were a number of folks that really jumped in. I appreciate your help as well with this. A lot of folks out there in the audience that helped out, so thank you.
That's great. You're welcome. Thank you very much. Okay, House Bill 2413 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation with Representative Olson carrying the bill. Now we are ready for a public hearing on 2413. Keely.
This measure creates the Oregon Traumatic Brain Injury Strategic Partnership Advisory Council as an advisory group for the governor and the Department of Human Services. It directs DHS to provide staff support, data, and information to the council. It directs DHS to encourage and facilitate collaboration among agencies and community participation in the development of a comprehensive plan to address the needs of individuals with brain injuries and to issue a report to the legislature. Also directs DHS to conduct a public awareness campaign and provide funding to facilitate support groups.
Great. And I believe Chief Smith wants to come first. Representative Keely Smith. Keely and I came in together into the legislature in 2001.
Yes, that was very exciting.
It was.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Tootie Smith. I'm with the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. We have before you today House Bill 2413. It is an exact copy of the law that is currently in Washington State. They've had much success with it in being able to oversee, take care of, and fund people with brain injuries. What we're asking for in this is the governor will appoint an advisory council to study brain injuries, the treatment thereof, and the progress that we're making in the state of Oregon. But I think the most important part of this bill is the funding aspect. About every state east of the Mississippi has some type of funding mechanism in place that funds the study, treatment, and socialization of people with brain injuries. What we've asked for today is an assessment on moving traffic violations of $2 per traffic violation. In the Washington law, when somebody gets a traffic violation, they go before the judge, and the judge makes it optional whether he can assess that additional $2 or not. In Oregon, we tried to copy that, but when we went to legislative council, they advised us that because of Oregon laws, it can't be done that way. I have not had a chance to talk with the drafter and LC about this. So the way that's written, the law in this is not permissive. The word shall is used, and that's why. If we want to get further into this, I think we'd have to talk to LC about that. In Washington, for the biennium, they will have collected almost $4 million on their assessments. In Oregon, we think it's going to be quite a bit less. We think maybe $1 million per year, possibly less than $2 million per biennium. And we'd like to collect this money, and we'd like to set up a fund. I have offered amendments to the bill that we would like to see in it, and it's language copied off the OPI, Oregon Project Independence Fund, and it sets up a separate and distinct fund outside the DHS, but it's monitored by DHS and distributed by DHS, but it's a separate fund within the Department of the Treasury. The reason for that is at the end of the biennium, those funds can be have overlapped into the next Miami's funds for the Brain Injury Association, and if there are any monies left over, interest can accrue. So the fund can be set aside especially, and interest can be earned especially for peoples with brain injury associations and the people who treat them. This law is something that I think is just really long overdue in this state. I've been working on the brain injury probably since I left the legislature. I came to it 25 years ago. My uncle sustained a horrific brain injury in a car accident. He hadn't forever changed his life, and if it hadn't been for the huge support system of family, I'm not sure where he'd end up today. He also had some private insurance, medical insurance, car insurance, but still he was forever changed, and he was forced to retire early and not become a citizen and work well into his later years like he had planned to. However, there are many people out there who do not have that support system. I would say most people support systems. And the thing about brain injury is, and you'll have some people testify before you today who have brain injuries and you would never know it. However, they are not able to live productive lives. One of the things that we have found for recovery of brain injuries is cognitive therapy. Excuse me, I'm swallowing because I have a cold. Cognitive therapy, if a person that sustains a brain injury can get into cognitive therapy immediately, similar to a stroke patient if they're treated immediately. It will not cure the brain injury. However, it will help them in a long way into getting themselves back to being an independent person and quite possibly in the workforce. Maybe not what they used to do in the workforce, but at least they would have a sense of value being able to go back to work. I cannot think of anything else that I need to say right now, so I'm going to turn it over to Sherry Stock. She is the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, and then we have some people coming to testify. They hear quite compelling testimony. It's more important than what I have to say, so I'm going to be quiet now and turn it over to Sherry.
Thank you, Representative. Good to see you again, Sherry.
Hi. My name is Sherry Stock, Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association and the mother of a severely brain-injured child. Adult, he's 41 now, injured by a drunk driver when he was 3 months. I have been with the Brain Injury Association since 2004, and in that capacity have answered literally thousands of phone calls and helped hundreds of people, from Alec Geese, a vet that sustained a severe brain injury in Iraq, and his family, and a number of people. We've now reached out into the Russian community, a young woman who sustained a brain injury in a rollover accident. So we're making inroads. And the number of people that sustain injuries, brain injuries, is actually in the hundreds of thousands. It's the number one public epidemic there is. But it's very, very underreported because a lot of times your broken leg or a ruptured spleen will get priority over your brain injury. And without a TBI registry, which this bill would fund, there's no way to really accurately know how many in the state of Oregon have brain injuries. And it was that Oregon, percentage-wise, according to the Center for Disease Control, did have the highest rates of brain injury because we had the highest the industries that had the highest rate of brain injury, which was agricultural and from farming accidents, and timber. Well, timber's kind of gone away. But loggers have an incredibly high rate of brain injury and death, but brain injury. And so I handed out a sheet on the statistics of brain injury, but I just want to throw something out that during the first year after a brain injury, TBI is associated with an estimated $642 million in lost wages, $96 million in lost income taxes, and $353 million in increased public assistance. So it's huge. So what this bill would do is be to fund a 1-800 number, so and then also have the public awareness along with it to not only help families and people with brain injury into resources that are already existing in the community and offered by the state, but also the awareness would help prevent injuries. I mean, the fastest growing injury group right now are young children in sports. Coaches are have annual training in child abuse, but they have no training in sports concussion whatsoever. And so this would be increasing the awareness to coaches to and providing training for them, using community resources once again. We're trying to use community resources as much as possible. All the funding, all the costs to DHS would come out of the funds that are raised. So it wouldn't be additional costs to DHS. It would fund the TBI registry. It would fund the TBI council representative. But anybody on the council would be doing it voluntarily, so there would be no cost there. And I think, one other thing, and then we have a lot of people that want to talk, is in Oregon alone, with the research we have done, we have found that 32% of all traumatic brain injuries that required hospitalization were from motor vehicle accidents. And those were the ones that just required the hospitalization. And the ones that were counted as having a TBI as opposed to something else. So this is a huge problem that, with a little bit of money and from the people that are really causing the problem, that could change the lives of many.
Thank you, Sherry. I have a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, this would have to go to revenue then before it would go to the floor, right? Well, I would ask Sherry that, or Keeley that. The other thing, is somebody going to be addressing the injuries of people who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan?
I don't see Jim Willis here. So
okay, we heard about that issue last session. That was just
that was very big in the war over there. That's probably like the biggest.
That's a signature injury.
Signature injury, the war. That's what I wanted to say, because of so many bombings, you know, car bombs and suicide bombs. You know, it's a concussion impact injury, and a lot of folks are coming back. And in Oregon, especially, we have a high percentage of our guards who are reservists and volunteers, and they don't get a lot of the services that veterans get. And if, you know, that, so it's huge. And there are some veterans people floating around the building. We didn't bring them in specifically to testify on this bill, but that is a large population. And those people would be able to take advantage of this.
And also, they would have a part on the council.
Yeah, they have a seat on the council. The council members are outlined in the bill, and we think it's really important that veterans get on the council.
And I think what was so compelling last session, maybe this is what you're going to talk about, was how many people are coming back from these two wars with brain injuries where in previous wars they would have died, but because they can get immediate help.
Well, it's amazing, the hospitals that are virtually set up, MASH hospitals online, that
right.
do brain injury surgery immediately,
right.
where they hadn't been before. I've seen pictures of the inside of these aircraft, and Representative Maurer knows about this more. They're like mini hospitals that fly mm-hmm. around to war zones,
right.
and they're able to do these surgeries where it relieves pressure on the brain to prevent additional injury or maybe permanent damage. I'm not an expert on that, but it is pretty tremendous.
If we have further hearings on this, perhaps we should have somebody
okay.
from veterans who would come and talk with us about that. Representative Callan.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to let you know that we can coordinate with the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee,
right.
which I chair, and it is a part of the conversation, the interim committee on Interim Task Force on Veterans Affairs recognizes traumatic brain injury as one of the issues, and it's in general. I've got a great big book on their report. It is part of it. There's very much an interest in the on part of the veterans community, and I'm sure that the two of us can coordinate the information going back between the two settings in which we're talking about this.
Terrific. Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the Sherry for bringing this bill forward. One question I have is, why just $2? Why not $5 or $10?
That's what Senator Morissette said. We got to have $5.
I don't think this is the right economic time, and to ask for more than that. We would rather get our, you know, get something rather than be killed by going up to $5. And I think we had $2 is what Washington did, and it got through with $2, and I think that was, it's sufficient to fund what we've listed in here, and, you know, maybe in the future we could go for 50.
Yeah, follow up. Thank you. And that's what I was going to suggest. If you're as successful as I'm sure you will be, and I mean that in the couch term successful, I think you're going to see a tsunami of these cases coming forward. And maybe after a few years you can raise it if you need to, because Alec is my constituent.
I know.
And I've talked to him quite a bit, and, you know, even if anybody was half of Alec and his advocacy for this issue, it would be, and I know the guys who come back are, but the one of the things you said, Tootie, also, the advances in the trauma care that these people are receiving, not only there, but here when someone has a car crash, you know, it's probably the first question they're asked when they're contacted inside the vehicle is, did you hit your head? And if they can't tell you they didn't, they're treated as if they might have. So,
Sherry, would you explain what that judge did about the $50 assessment?
Actually, we have someone else that's going to address that, but we have had a judge down a case in Medford, and a family member is going to address that, where we were awarded, the Brain Injury Association has been awarded $50 a month for 5 years from a young driver who was talking on a cell phone and hit actually a social worker for the state of Oregon, and he will never work again. And so I wanted to just go back to Alec a little bit. Alec is, if you haven't met him, a really outstanding man that went to Iraq and Afghanistan, had the distinction to be the first National Guardsman in Oregon to have a known traumatic brain injury. And he went from making $6,000 a month to being totally disabled and about like maybe a third grader, I would say. That's about his level. My son's like about an 18-month-old. He would come in, he's 6'3", but he has a vocabulary of about 100 words. And so he looks normal, but there's nobody home. And this is from all from a drunk driver with Mark. With Alec, it's from actually his truck flipped over on him. And with our National Guard, unfortunately, our National Guard are the ones that are in the transportation. That means in the front lines. And we have another distinction nationally is that we have more women having brain injury than any other state because we have so many National Guardsmen going. And approximately the government is admitting to 20 to 30% are coming back with a brain injury. And that right now they're estimating it to being 320,000 nationally. And that's a huge percentage that are going to be on the society and their family members. And the military, the DVBICS, has put out a fabulous video that is encouraging family members to learn how to take care of these people. These people are going to be coming back violent, have some real severe issues, and it's really going to fall to the family members to take care of them because the facilities don't exist to take care of people at this rate. So it's a major problem.
Thank you, Sherry. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tootie and Sherry, a couple of things. I commend you for going after the $2. And Madam Chair doesn't like us to get political up here, so I won't go further than that. Otherwise, I would tell you guys that maybe you should consult some other people in the building that are going after the gusto up front on beer and cigarettes and everything. But anyway, but I won't say that because...
But we might be able to pay for that.
But a question I do have is the $2, do we know what other funds that those might be drawing from, if it's say $100 ticket, mm-hmm. something like that, and $2 of it will be designated. I'm assuming that right now that $2 is going
there
elsewhere.
No,
it's
this is
it's in addition to. Okay.
Beg your pardon, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is an additional $2. That's why we only left it at $2.
So, for instance, a seatbelt is $97. It would go up to $99.
Okay. All righty.
Follow up?
Just quickly, would this include I saw the shaken baby. So would it also include like brainstem neurological problems and not just a, you know, a traumatic brain hit?
What we intended to include is anything that is an acquired brain injury. An acquired brain injury is shaken baby. It is a stroke, and strokes are a huge percentage of people with brain injury. And traumatic brain injury is one of the things. Having a heart attack, anoxic injury, so a heart attack that would cause temporary loss of oxygen to the brain is an acquired brain injury. So all of those people would be covered. Another thing that we didn't mention would be that would be covered in this bill is a small stipend to all the support groups. We have support groups in every center for independent living in the state, and this would offset the cost of the support groups, which is for copying and a little bit of time. But we have right now we have 49 support groups throughout the state, and we'd like to see more. There's more that are needed.
And that stipend would be about $50 that will go to each of these support groups just to help with a little bit. We said 50 because we don't know how much money is going to be brought in.
Thank you.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. One of the interesting things for me is that in looking at the makeup of your advisory council, and you mentioned that sports is oftentimes a significant factor, it would seem that for me, that having somebody from either OSAA, the school athletic association, or somebody from education be sitting on this, or somebody out there in the professional sports world where men get hurt and have brain injuries, that maybe having a representative from that might be a good idea.
That brings up another bill that we have, Senate Bill 381.
348.
348, I get them mixed up. Has to do with concussions for football sports injuries, and it's the football helmet bill. I'm not sure if this committee will hear that, but we had OSAA members come in and testify about that, getting rid of football helmets that are 10 years older, and then educating all coaches on how to identify concussions, all coaches at every sport level. But, you know, that's a good idea to having that member on there.
And I think what we'll do is, like Dr. Jim Chestnut up at OHSU is on OSAA. He is sports medicine MD, and he's very interested in being on this advisory council if it passes. So we would have people that would be, you know, wearing lots of different hats, as many as possible. I think the biggest thing on the advisory council is brain injury crosses all disabilities. 60% of people that have spinal cord injuries have a brain injury. And so it's people with mental illness, a lot of them are diagnosed with a brain injury, with a mental illness, but they really have a brain injury, or they have both. You know, it's just, it crosses all lines. And my son is labeled as developmentally disabled because he was an infant, but he has a brain injury. So it's just all lines that it crosses. So we've tried to, the makeup of the board is trying to pull everybody out of their little cubicles and into talking about working together for the better of the whole. And a big part of that would be the VA. Because that's really going to affect this state since we're National Guard, and the state is going to be paying for them. But it's everyone coming to the table for the good.
Great. Thank you so much. We have quite a few people who are wanting to testify. So thank you so much for bringing this to
us.
I'm going to call, is it Lisa Millett? Millet? And Gary Cohen? And Joanne Rawlings? Or Joan Molly. Go ahead. Go ahead. Whoever's down first.
Good morning. My name's Lisa Millett, and I am the manager for the Injury Prevention and Epidemiology section in Oregon Public Health Division in the Department of Human Services. And you have my testimony. I won't read it, but a couple of things I wanted to tell you was that our injury section does data work on traumatic brain injury, and the sources for those data are hospitalization data and death certificate data. The data that Sherry presented from the federal sources are estimates for Oregon that are drawn from a population sample that doesn't include Oregon. And so the numbers on my testimony are much smaller. They also don't include emergency department data because we don't have emergency department data system in Oregon to draw from. So basically my testimony says there are about 640 deaths due to TBI a year, and the causes of those deaths are firearms, motor vehicle crashes, and falls. It says that there are about 2,500 hospitalizations due to TBI a year in Oregon, and those are primarily elderly people falling and motor vehicle crashes. Now, milder brain injuries that might be treated in emergency departments and released are not included in these data. So they're definitely an undercount. We think a registry would be really helpful to identify how many people, because we don't know how many people. We don't know where they live. And we don't know how to assess the need for services or access to services or even how to do service alignment in the state. However, working for department, I have to say that there will be a fiscal impact, and we're not sure what it would be, so we're neutral on the bill.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, I'm always impressed with the epidemiology section of Public Health Service or Public Health Division. You guys do great work, and this would be beneficial for you, wouldn't it? I mean, really, in identifying the population, and I'm assuming you would work closely with this group to help get the information that would be most useful. I'm looking for a nod, maybe. Or
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, registries in the states that have them in the U.S. are used, or the data are collected generally by injury programs, and they're used to identify individuals and families that need access to care. They're used to do outreach, and they're also used, and I think this is most important, to look at primary prevention and how we can learn to prevent more brain injury from occurring.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up.
But
you can help them ask the right questions, making sure that they're, in fact, getting the right information or information that's useful to you?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, there are a great many brain injury registries in the U.S., and if we were to develop one in Oregon, we'd probably use one of the model states, models, instead of recreating the wheel. And the purposes for those are the purposes that this bill describes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
And I hope I didn't just miss this because I spaced out for a minute here reading your paper. But is there some sort of mechanism for when I know you said you don't track emergency department injuries, but is there some way that when someone comes in, for example, an older person after a fall, and they don't know if they hurt themselves because of the fall or their fall was caused because they had a stroke or whatever, is there some way that they think about this and screen for it, or is there a way to screen for it?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, one of the most, I would say, difficult things about brain injury these days is the research and what is known about brain injury and studying and identifying brain injury has changed a great deal. Most physicians and people working in the medical field aren't up on the latest research. Dr. Chestnut, that you spoke of, is working to educate physicians across the state at this point in time. It's one of the sad things about brain injury is a lot of brain injury is never identified, and because some of the symptomology looks like mental illness or looks like other neurological problems that people might have, that they're never identified with brain injury, and therefore they might never receive the services they need.
Thank you.
So a follow-up. I guess then a comment would be so that probably the most obvious ones do get that attention and that consideration, but for example, a bad car crash, an obvious head injury, but someone who falls and might, well, and I'm just thinking a woman here in the building fell the other day, hit her head on a table and here in the Galleria, and nothing showed. But she came up to our office, and my staff suggested she go get it checked out, and she did. She ended up in the emergency department of the Salem Hospital, and she's all right. But, I mean, that normally would just get up, and that would be it. But if she didn't, if it wasn't that I just hit my head, and I'm here to get it checked out, that kind of thing. So I'm just wondering if there's, you know, like in, when someone's in a car crash, the first question you ask is, did you hit your head? And it's almost like, what happened? And they look at you like, I'm in a wreck, you know, duh. And they don't always know if they did or they, or did you pass out? Did you, were you wearing your seatbelt? When clearly they weren't. And they'll say yes. So you know there's something going on. But just wondering if that's how hard would that be to put that into that that list of questions you get asked when you come in? You don't have to answer that.
Okay, we're going to move on. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Jerry Cohen. I am an inactive attorney. I understand that the highest incidence of motor vehicle accident is in the population of people 25 to 35. I was a passenger in a single vehicle high-speed rollover accident driven by somebody in that age group. I don't remember anything about the accident or trip to the emergency room or a lot that happened there. I can tell you that the treating physician did not mention I had been unconscious, did not mention a concussion, did not alert me to the possibility of a brain injury. I went back to work the following week. Several months later was referred to a neurologist, and a year after the fact was finally sent to out for a neuropsychological evaluation. At that point, it was determined I had sustained a mild diffuse brain injury. As a result of the neurological evaluation, it was recommended that I terminate my practice. So I could no longer practice the profession in which I had engaged for 27 years. Being unable to locate a job, even part-time, for several months, I entered the Voc Rehab program. And ultimately, as a final stage, became a volunteer at the Brain Injury Association of Oregon and am now on their board of directors and unable to sustain a job for 20 hours a week. So I'm not working, but I do work on an occasional basis. During this journey, I had no idea how isolated I had become until I attended my first support group meeting a year and a half after the accident. I had no awareness of what was happening, what was going on. I was told I was going to be fine. I believed it. And after going to that first support group meeting, I met people who understood what I was trying to say, even if the words didn't come out right. Support groups are invaluable not only as an educational basis, but for basis of support for people and their families. And they need to be made much more available because it is often the only social interaction brain injury survivors have. I knew nothing about support services or the Brain Injury Association, was advised of nothing, and so learned this on my own. And I would have been so much farther ahead had I had known that these resources were available in terms of educating myself, perhaps educating my family members, physicians. So I'm really it's supportive of this bill in terms of the public awareness, not only the public, but also the professionals who treat survivors. And funding the support groups. The one I attend in Eugene, they've done it for 16 years. Totally voluntary. They provide refreshments at their expense and speakers at their expense and coffee at their expense.
Thank you so much. We're glad to see you here. Hope that things go better for you.
Oh, they're wonderful.
Good.
I've reinvented myself.
That's terrific. Go
ahead. My name is Joan Rawlings Boyd, and you have my written testimony. I'm a speech-language pathologist, and I work in acute care currently, but I've worked in the field of brain injury for almost the past 30 years, and in the course of that, I've treated patients, clients across the continuum of care from acute care very early on after their injuries to community reentry. So I've seen a lot. Of people on their journey at the very beginning and much later on. However, in May of 2006, my interest and involvement in brain injury became much more personal. My brother-in-law sustained a severe brain injury when he was hit by a car, an 18-year-old driver talking on his cell phone while he was on a bike ride. He was a triathlete and was on a training ride. And Russ was, my brother-in-law, was stopped at a stop sign, and this young man took a left-hand turn into his bike. Months of rehabilitation followed after 3 weeks of being comatose, and it was a very difficult time for my brother-in-law and sister. And Russ's life, their lives, will never be the same, as Jerry was attesting to. My brother-in-law was a social worker for the Children's Services Division of the State of Oregon, a job that he could not return to. It's been almost 3 years, and they have worked, my sister and brother-in-law have worked very hard to put their lives back together, their new life. And Russ continues to have to work on finding ways to give value to this new life. And one of those ways that he's found is by participating in a brain injury support group in Medford. Because he was able to return to driving, he's able to provide that service to other members of that support group where a lot of them aren't able to drive. And it really has, it's his thing, and it's added value to his life. And Sherry and Tootie mentioned this before, but as part of their settlement, it was my brother-in-law's idea. And if you know at all about brain injury, for him to have this stellar idea was just brilliant. And it was his idea to, as part of the settlement, have the driver write a monthly check to the Brain Injury Association of Oregon for 5 years. And his and my sister's reasoning in that was in the hopes that he might appreciate the impact that his driving had on other people's lives, and it reinforced that link between driving and brain injuries. Hopefully it reinforced that link. That link in statistics, anecdotally for me as a professional and as in my personal life as well, that link between TBI and driving is undeniable, absolutely undeniable. Making that link more explicit in the form of this $2 additional fee ultimately would help survivors and their families deal with the tremendous human and economic impact of TBI, which is something that, unless you know about, it's almost unfathomable how much your life can be impacted by this. And that's why I strongly support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. to tell us your story today. Representative Olson.
Yes, Madam Chair. Joan, I have a real close friend down in Albany that had almost an identical issue occur to him several years ago. Excuse me. Where he was sitting at a stop sign, individual just, you know, crashed into him. And he was out for several weeks. I'm curious about your brother-in-law. Has he been able to get his driver's license back yet?
Yes, he has.
That's huge.
It is huge. He went through that. Everybody was pretty nervous about that. I'm a speech pathologist. My sister, his wife, is a physical therapist. My husband is a neuropsychologist. Russ had probably more support than he wanted to have, but because, yes, he had the treatment team. But because of that, we were very cautious, and he went through two occupational therapy evaluations that said, yes, he's ready to drive again. But he still, when he's fatigued, it doesn't go so well. So he has to be very careful.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. We'll move on to Amy. Is it Keem? Ream. Thank you. Jillian Holbrook and Don Bischoff. Is he here? Just introduce yourselves, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Amy Ream. I'm an Oregon physician, and I had a traumatic brain injury in 2006 and found that although I looked pretty normal, I was unable to continue in my work. So I am no longer a physician taking care of Oregon residents, and I no longer pay taxes. My statement is pretty brief, and I have several others to read to you that are also brief from people who are involved in the issue but who could not be here today. My feeling is that since many TBIs are caused by motor vehicle accidents, that the punishment should fit the crime and that this is a very logical place to find resources to address the issue, which has been not addressed adequately in Oregon. And on the principle of reducing misery and expense, I think this is a good way to start, because every survivor who can return to work and every survivor who can leave intensive rehabilitation inpatient residential care, and everyone who can live independently will save the state many dollars for every dollar that is spent in the outreach and the treatment. It was only by coincidence that I found out about support groups in the Portland area, and like others here to testify, I have found the support groups extremely helpful and supportive and informative. It's hard to explain. It's about like trying to explain to someone who's never had a baby what it's like to have a baby. You cannot understand what it feels like to have your brain feel like it's mush. Or, you know, I've given a lecture about brain injury, and half my lecture was stupid stuff I've been told since I've had a brain injury. There was plenty to talk about there. And the other half was metaphors for brain injury that I've collected from other brain injury survivors, and people have all kinds of interesting ways to describe what it feels like inside their head. But I won't go into all those now. In case you're curious, you can ask. And I do think that information needs to get out to more people through our official sources like hospitals and physicians who really don't know what they need to know. I also think that the VA hospital and system are not going to be able to meet the needs of our returning veterans and guardsmen in spite of what they say. And I hope I don't get my tires slashed. But I think the responsibility will fall to us citizens to fill the gap, because there's a big gap. So I support HB 2413. And I'd like to add that to answer one of your questions, Representative Boone, mechanism of injury can include trauma inside the skull without an external concussion. You know about that, the coup, counter coup. So I know people who've had simply a whiplash injury inside a car. They never hit the steering wheel, and they still had a functional brain injury that impaired their ability to do what they needed to do.
That includes blast injuries as well. There are seem to be shock waves that can impact the head, so they don't even have to have a direct impact on the head to have a significant brain injury. Also, your question trying to distinguish between a fall caused by a trip or an injury caused by a fall or a fall caused by some other medical situation. I can tell you that when I was doing anesthetics for people with fractured hips and other injuries, we always tried to find out, but you couldn't always.
Thank you.
You just, they didn't know.
Because they fell.
It could have been a cardiac arrhythmia. It could have been a heart attack. It could have been a stroke. It could have been a trip. Especially if there's nothing obvious like a heart attack that you can find eventually with blood tests and EKGs and all that, or a stroke that you can deduce, but can't always know. But we did try. Okay, that's me. May I enter some testimony from people who cannot be
short?
Well, I told everybody no more than 3 minutes.
Oh, so you're reading for several people 3 minutes worth of testimony for each one?
Yeah.
Can you just sort of summarize each one? That would be great.
Okay. Pat Murray?
Then you can pass them to us. Do you have enough copies for all of us?
I have some copies, and I'm going to make more copies.
And you can give it to our staff, and he can make copies for all of us.
Oh, he can.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Lucky you. Thank you. Okay. Pat Murray was a teacher, a counselor, and a principal. And she had a brain injury from a trip in a dark hallway in a commercial place and went headfirst into a steel door, had a brain injury, has had several surgeries, has not been able to go back to work, has problems with memory, has problems with stamina. A lot of people with brain injury have stamina problems. They're like a lithium battery. They can walk out the door and they know their batteries just didn't charge that day and they have to go back home. It's amazing. I have a lot of stamina, relatively. So her career was messed up, and she really found a lot of help with the brain injury support group also. That's how I met her. Let's see, what else did she want to say? She's now working for Brain Injury Association, taking some of the many calls that come in asking for help to send information out. And we really need more help to be able to get in that information and send out more information. We don't even have the funds for enough postage to send it all out. We need more. So that would be very helpful. Okay, that's enough on that one. Here's one from Pat's sister, Dr. Elizabeth Frick in Boston, Massachusetts. I do not know what kind of doctor she is. Anyway, she said, the sister that I had known ceased to be. The strong, active, energetic career woman who just completed her educational administrative degree was now walking with a cane, had difficulty with balance, vision, and memory. I recall many discussions about how difficult it had become for her to function anywhere near the level she had previously performed at work. She's had intensive therapy and 2 cervical disc surgeries. The difficulty she had finding effective resources to recovery was shocking. There was such a lack of clinical understanding and resources in the professional community, and I have to regretfully agree with that. My sister struggled and fought to piece back together a supportive team of professionals, and it's very hard. Okay, she's a tireless advocate and pioneer in her community and a testimony to the impact of treatment and support to recovery. She is my hero. There's another one. Here's one from Fern Wilgus from Portland, Oregon, who had she did not have a traumatic brain injury. She had a stroke, an acquired brain injury. She's recently had a second small stroke, and certainly what she learned after the first one helped her find her way through the second one. And she simply is agreeing, really, that she felt isolated and bereft after her experience, and she was greatly helped by finding a support group. I would like to add, and this speaks to all of these people, that I think part of the nature of the injury is that people become less able to advocate for themselves, not thinking clearly, not speaking clearly, and certainly not thinking fast on their feet, and that's partly why I stopped. I'm getting better. I'm 3 years out. I'm better than I was. There's a lot less Vaseline on my windshield than there used to be.
Good.
In fact, hardly ever see Vaseline anymore. But that was my metaphor. I believe that Fern also is a retired veteran. So she served our country and is no longer able to do that. Okay, here's another one from Kathy DeDomingo, who is, I'm not even sure what all these abbreviations are, MS, probably Masters of Social Work, and a CCC SLP. So some of those things have to do with social work and human services. I am a speech and language pathologist. Here we go. She represents the Brain Injury Rehabilitation Center at PRA in the Cedar Hills area of Southwest Portland. And for those of you who don't know, the only brain injury recovery specialist, physiatrist in the state, has her office there. So we are underserved. We are an outpatient multidisciplinary program that provides a variety of rehab services to survivors of acquired brain injury, whether stroke, illness, or accident. Our focus is on returning survivors to their highest level of function. She's moving to support this bill. And according to CDC, 20% of all TBI in the U.S. are caused by motor vehicle accidents. And she has a little more statistics. Of the 76 adults that they've treated, 45 have suffered TBI, accounting for 60% of their clients. Of those 45, 26 were due to a motor vehicle accident, which means 58%. So that's really high. Again, I think that the punishment fits the crime here.
Amy, is that the last one you have?
Yes, it is.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
It says here in our program, the average time since injury has to treatment has been anywhere from 11 to 43 months. And I would like to say that treatment, even at a very later date, can improve a person's functionality. And it would be really helpful to be able to shorten the time to receiving treatment.
Great. Thank you so much. Would you give us your name and then tell us your testimony? And maybe move the microphone.
Yeah. My name is Jillian Holbrook. I live in Multnomah County. On February 21st, 2005, I parked my car across the street from the grocery store, got out and headed to where I intended to cross the street. I saw that a car was stopped at a stop sign across the street. I wanted to be sure that the driver saw me, so I looked at him until I was sure we made eye contact with each other. I then looked left and right and proceeded when the coast was clear. I was then hit by the car that had been at the stop sign, thrown first up on the windshield, then down by the wheel of the car. At some point, my head hit the curb. I was taken to Emmanuel Hospital and released 2 days later. The police report stated the car hit me in the crosswalk, but the driver was not ticketed. I have hospital photos. Would you like to see?
Ma'am, I'll take them.
The story of my recovery is full of ups and downs, includes 6 eye surgeries, and is quite long. At one point, not long after the accident, I began to notice problems with dizziness, confusion, and nausea. I had successfully completed a course of cognitive therapy at the trauma clinic, but still felt far from normal, so I set about to find help on my own. On my computer, I found a traumatic brain injury support group nearby. When I walked into that meeting, it felt like coming home. There was information on many, many resources, and most notably, people who understood what I was experiencing. Specifically, the facilitator for that support group helped me twice later on to strategize when I was having communication difficulties with surgeons. Over the course of 3 years, my traumatic brain injury treatment has included work with a physiatrist, a neurological physical therapist, a neurological optometrist, and 2 cognitive therapists. All these people have made an enormous difference in the quality of my life since the car hit me. I feel quite fortunate that I stumbled upon the information that led me to that first TBI support group. I urge you to enact House Bill 2413 because others who need help might not be so lucky. This bill will increase awareness and visibility of this very important resource. It will make it so much easier for traumatic brain injury survivors to find the help and support that is essential to their recovery. Thank you.
Thank you, Jillian. Those pictures are appalling, certainly. Say, a picture means, what is 1,000 words? It is amazing that you survived that. That was incredible. Any questions of any of these quick...
Isn't it amazing that the driver wasn't ticketed when it was so clearly in the crosswalk, et cetera?
Yes. Thank you so much, Jillian.
You're welcome.
I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, committee members, my name is Don Bischoff. I'm legislative assistant to Senator Bill Morissette, who couldn't be here today because he's chairing his own committee hearing a bill on medical marijuana. You can imagine how much fun that is. I won't go into my testimony, which is fairly brief, but just wanted to tell you that Bill has been working on traumatic brain injury bills since at least 2003 and perhaps back as far as 2001, because he's been educated first by Bill Olson and more recently by Sherry Stock about the extent of the problem and the lack of resources that there are for people who have traumatic brain injuries. One of the problems he's had registry bills previously in the legislature. They've always been foundered somewhere along the line in ways and means. Never got the were able to get any general funding. He thinks this unitary assessment is a good way to finally overcome that problem. And he strongly urges your passage of the bill.
Great, thank you so much. Any further questions of anyone on this panel? Thank you so much. Thank you for coming. We wish you the best of luck. Bob Jundeff, Wayne Eklund, and is there anyone else who wishes to speak? Anyone who didn't sign up? You know the bill, just tell us who you are and start talking.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I'm here today to speak in support of this bill. Our organization is one of the organizations listed that would be a member of the advisory group or commission. I don't remember exactly which one it is, but I just wanted to tell you a little bit about this area and why we're involved with it. In the year 2000, the Traumatic Brain Injury Act was passed by Congress, and it authorized some money as part of the Children's Health Act of 2000 to go toward advocacy and support for people with traumatic brain injury. It was explained at that time, and actually, although we've served people with traumatic brain injury for years, I learned a lot more about traumatic brain injury in the course of the development of that legislation. And what was pointed out at that time is that, in a sense, traumatic brain injury has become a new disability in that because of the advances in medical technology, there's people who are both diagnosed and able to survive and return to society because their injuries are things that would have killed them in the past or would have gone undiagnosed. And so what we've come to learn is that increasing numbers of individuals in our society have this disability, and the numbers are growing and they're large. According to national statistics, we're looking now at about 2% of the population who have been diagnosed with a significant brain injury, and according to the statistics I have, about two-thirds of soldiers who are returning from Iraq who are wounded have diagnosed traumatic brain injury. So the problem is significant. But the infrastructures that exist for other types of disabilities just weren't there. Many of the types of groups were formed in the 70s, and 80s around disabilities just weren't there for traumatic brain injury. So we've been playing catch-up for years. In that 2000 Act, some money was created for advocacy for people with traumatic brain injury that came to our organization. So we've been doing this since that time. The amount that was originally allocated to us funded a part-time position. It hasn't increased since that time, so we still have a part-time attorney who does advocacy for traumatic brain injury. And I just want to tell you a little bit about that work because it gives you a sense of some of the challenges. Traumatic brain injuries affect people in very unique ways, and of course they're invisible disabilities. And so when an individual presents themselves in society, it isn't automatically obvious that that person has some limitations, and those limitations may vary widely, and that creates its own set of problems for folks, and many times very challenging problems in terms of a variety of areas, including providing advocacy, because if a person has memory problems or if they have communications problems, even though they present well, this can create all sorts of difficulties in their lives. So in the workplace, for example, finding accommodations for people to remain in the workplace can be a challenging activity just in terms of just identifying the disability and then finding things that work to keep the person at work. If the person's unable to work, getting that person some benefits to provide some income can also be challenging because you have to have the full documentation in order to do that, and diagnosis is expensive and rehabilitation is expensive. In housing, people, traumatic brain injury can cause problems in terms of people retaining and finding housing, remembering to pay their rent, having behaviors that may be difficult for a landlord, and again, finding appropriate accommodations in those situations can be challenging. Because traumatic brain injury is not singled out in a particular area in our state service system, finding appropriate services for people who may have increased demands for service because of their traumatic brain injury can be difficult. So they're in our SPD area, but there isn't a specialized area that works just on traumatic brain injury. Folks can have associated mental health needs. They can have addictions problems and self-medicating to address the problems of their traumatic brain injury. Need vocational rehabilitation services, and again, their traumatic brain injury will make receiving those services oftentimes more difficult just in terms of making appointments and carrying through with the treatment regimen. For children, education, a large number of individuals who have traumatic brain injury acquire them in infancy or youth, falling off of the changing table. Other types of falls or injuries. Kids who get into auto accidents, high rate in teenagers acquiring injuries in sports and skiing. And again, getting education services can then become more demanding. In dealing with police, Representative Olson, a large number of people who live lifestyles that lead to violence oftentimes can acquire traumatic brain injuries through those behaviors, and these can create challenges in terms of corrections and in police interaction. So in all of those realms, we find that we are advocating for folks just in order to move through service systems. So this is and that's why we're very excited to be able to be part of an organized effort by the state. And I want to compliment Sherry Stock for all the work that she's done now and over the years, Bill Olson and the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. These are very good people. They're doing very good work, not making the big bucks doing it, I assure you. And I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you very much, Bob. And we'll hear the next testimony before we have questions.
My name is Wayne Eklund. Thank you. I hadn't intended to speak. I'm a registered nurse and current vice president of the board of directors of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, past president. And I've been working on this legislation for a long time. I'm always sort of in the background and really hadn't intended to speak, but I just want to confirm that everything that people have testified two here today is absolutely true. And that's really all I have to say.
Thank you for coming to testify. Bob, we may not be through if you haven't asked your questions yet.
Oh.
Thank you for coming today, and thanks for the work you do. Any questions?
Tomorrow is an
Madam Chair, he's feeling like he's back in the teacher's room again.
Seeing no questions, thank you very much for coming today and for your work in this field. Representative Smith, do you have any last words? We do have a few minutes left if you want to say anything more.
Oh, thank you. I just want to thank the committee for your open-mindedness on this. I think you are very sympathetic to the problem that we face. We desperately need some type of services. The Brain Injury Association does not make much money. We have fundraisers, auctions every year, and Sherry is our only paid person. Well, she's the executive director, does everything. Works 10 hours, 7 days a week, and longer if it's possible. And so we have a brain injury national conference this weekend that she's preparing for. And you guys may, representatives may know and we have people from all over the United States, just a wealth of doctors and information and everything. So thank you for your sympathy and listening today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the work you're doing this, and certainly thanks to all the people who came to testify, and Sherry, thanks especially to you. Any last words? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My family has had direct personal experience with this over the last 3 or 4 years. I have a niece that, because of an auto accident, has been suffering from TBI, and the struggles that you go through, everything from rarely is there enough insurance from the person that hits you to do anything for you, that individual is rarely worth enough to even sue for. And the bills, in addition to your personal insurance, can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the interruption, the losses that we're hearing today to your profession and whatnot can be devastating to the person and the family, and it's tragic. And the additional physical problems that can be caused because the neurological damage can affect heart and many other aspects of physical and emotional health. So,
thank you, Representative Boone.
Well, maybe leave you with the last word. Sorry. In the Transportation Committee, we are hearing a bill that will not allow handheld phones, cell phones, and you know, they'll unless it's in response to an emergency or the push to talk, etc. But they'll require either, what do you call it, those little cyborg ear things.
Or not talking at all.
Or not talking at all.
Hands-free. Yeah.
Hands-free. And so that will, if that passes, that will do a lot to the two examples we heard today.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Thank you. All right. I will close the public hearing on 2413 and close the House Committee on Human Services. And thank you all very much. See you on the